note.
Well, maybe you're about to buy an electric car or a house in the suburbs far from your job. You might change your calculus based on this week's news. This week, the Washington State Transportation Commission voted to study replacing the gas tax with a pay-by-mile system. If you paid by how far you drive instead of how many gallons you buy, how would that affect you? And what do you think of the idea? Let us know right now on Facebook, our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio, or on Twitter. We are live tweeting, as always, at KUOW. We're on the phone, 206-685-2526. That's 685-BLAM. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. Glad you have power to hear my voice right now. With us, Crosscut.com's Knute Berger, Seattle Channel's Joni Balter, Northwest News Network Managing Editor Phyllis Fletcher. Welcome, all.
Good morning. Hey, Bill.
Lights stayed on last night?
Yeah, they did.
Tons of light.
Brief flickering at the bottom of Finney Ridge.
Neighborhood Christmas lights still on?
Yep.
Okay.
Seemed to be.
Yeah.
The Jewish lights?
Nice Jewish Christmas lights, as I referred to earlier.
Before our microphones open, what is a Jewish Christmas light?
Did that is a that joke out? On Christmas light.
Okay. Knute, you had a theory.
Oh, I thought they were little Chinese takeout containers.
Right.
Oh, like yum.
Well, glad mine flickered. My power flickered and stayed on. So let's start with the top story this week. What's that expression when you find yourself in a hole, stop digging? You know, we're trying to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct with a waterfront tunnel. It's been a challenge so far. Buried pipes and stranded berths. And now there's this other issue. How can the State Transportation Department put this delicately?
There's been a phenomenon that is taking place over a geographic area, kind of at the center of King Street and Alaskan Way, with ground movement that is roughly around an inch in some parts and then tapers out less than that as you move away.
What did he say? Knute, what is Todd Trepanier of WashDOT getting at there? What's going on?
Well, one thing he's trying to imply that it's a phenomenon, not a screw-up. But essentially what's happening is that Bertha is trapped underground. They have to dig what they call a rescue pit to go down and fix it.
I think they call it an access vault, actually, but we call it a rescue
vault,
pit.
Rescue pit. It's a giant hole in the ground. It happens to be that it's stuck in a place where the ground is saturated with water. It's landfill. Even when you get down below that, there's high water tables. And people who know the early history of Seattle know that all of Pioneer Square, much of it is built on fill. And if it wasn't fill, it was ground saturated with spring water and the runoff from the hills. So
the neighborhood is built on porridge.
Yes, basically. Basically it is. And it's one reason that, you know, after the Nisqually quake, all the cameras went down to look at the fallen bricks. It's unstable ground. When they plan to dig the tunnel, because they're going under a historic district, those buildings have special protections, they agreed to monitor to see whether the construction process of the tunnel would harm the buildings. And there was a lot of concern. They're going to go under part of downtown, too. So there was a lot of concern that because of the soil conditions and the tunneling process, there would be danger to those buildings. What they didn't anticipate was the rescue pit. So this is something new. And what they've been doing is they've been pumping out the groundwater. Well, when you pump out the water that's holding stuff up, the ground is going to shift. The ground, that kind of matrix down there is going to shift. So they've had to halt the digging process, or they can only go another couple of feet. They can't really go down further because they have to continue to pump that water out. Otherwise, the pit would come apart. Basically, they have to, you know, keep the water out of there because of the pressure that's exerted as they dig down. And what they're finding now is that in areas kind of southeast of where the rescue pit is are starting to sink.
Joni, if we can blame the sinkage on the groundwater pumping that we blame on the Berthestall, that we blame on Are we blaming it on Washington State for that Department of Transportation pipe, or are we blaming it on the tunneling company? Who is paying for this Michigas?
Well, isn't that the fun part of this? You know, so sometimes when you have a fix, it's worse than, or more challenging anyway, than what you were already trying to do. They were trying to dig a tunnel. They're trying to go 2 miles underground. They didn't get very far, 1,060 or something like that feet. And so then the seals all break, and so now we don't really know who is going to end up paying for this. This is obviously not going to be on time, and it's for sure not going to be on budget. My favorite phrase in all of this, and it's a perfect phrase for Seattle, dewatering. One of the best phrases in all of this. But I just wanted to add to the complications here. As you apparently, if you're already dewatering and you stop dewatering, that makes it even worse because it's a process that's in motion, and this is all about pulling the front part of Bertha up so you can figure out how to fix the seals. So who do I think is going to end up paying for this? Well, it's somewhere between Seattle Tunnel Partners and Hitachi, which sent this amazing and sometimes not so amazing machine over here. I have a question. Did this machine arrive with the seals already broken? We break them. That's what's going to be debated here. But you do know.
I heard somebody's theory that somebody at the port who didn't like not getting some of the work messed with the stuff when it came in over the ocean. Sabotaged it.
Was that person's name Rain?
Possibly.
Weather?
Yes, possibly.
Yeah.
Have you been covering this story as a Northwest story, or looking at Phyllis Fletcher, or looking at big repercussions of this?
Mostly we've been standing far, far away and cringing at this story. When it rises to the state politics level, we do occasionally, but a lot of that politics ends up playing out here, so we rely on KUOW.
But it is going to be, there are going to be lawsuits and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They're definitely, when I was more local in the KUOW newsroom, we were definitely covering the pre-lawsuit posturing that goes on, and the we don't know what happened, and the awkwardly phrased sound bites like what you just heard. We were doing a lot of that stuff.
And what a lot of people say is that, you know, Hitachi, which developed Bertha, you know, their worldwide reputation is at stake here. So this is what they do for a living. They build tunnels. They provide these machines that build tunnels around the world. And so they sort of have to get it right, if you think about that, just for the future. So there will be lawsuits, obviously, and they will sort out what condition did the machine arrive in, who broke it. Seattle Tunnel Partners have a design-build contract, which means they assume the risk like this. So this shall stir.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because there are big questions still unanswered. First, will they be able to rescue Bertha? Even if they're able to figure out a way to dig the pit without causing parts of Pioneer Square to collapse, so assume they figure that out. They still don't know what's wrong with it. They're going to replace the entire front, but they still have to haul it out. They have to figure out what went wrong. They have to put the new thing in, and then it has to be able to function. It has to be able to move forward. There's sufficient doubt about whether the project can even be completed that even the mayor has, in an abundance of caution, has slowed down some of the plans for the waterfront redevelopment, which is key, until we actually know whether it's going to work. So there's a huge amount at stake. The other thing is that all of this was predicted by somebody. In other words, there were consultants who reported on this project before ground was broken who said, you've got the wrong tunneling machine for the soil conditions. You've got the wrong piece of machinery in there. So the mayor was, you know, so to describe what's happening there now as a phenomenon, no, it's a screw up. This is not a natural disaster like an earthquake. This is a man-made problem.
Phenomenon.
It doesn't mean that it's not solvable, but it's also complicated by the fact that right now it's affecting both the viaduct. The whole purpose of building the tunnel was so you wouldn't shut down the viaduct until you were ready. Do you remember when the viaduct used to sink an inch? It was, oh, my God, we got to build the tunnel because the viaduct is going to fall down. Well, now huge sections are sinking an inch.
Yes.
And we're basically told, don't worry about it.
So we've laid out the problem for you. With all this in mind, we asked you on Facebook and Twitter, what do you envision? How is this going to turn out? And KUOW social media producer, Bon Huberman. Bon, what are our listeners saying?
Well, you know, one listener, Noah, described a very vivid dream he had. I won't read the entire dream, but in short, he describes, I was in an elevator. A tour guide explained, we are descending to a place below the streets of Seattle, to the Seattle Boring Machine Museum. The head of the thing has been locked in place under the streets of Seattle ever since. That was 50 years ago. The elevator opened, revealing a brightly lit area full of glass exhibit cases. The guide spoke again. On your right is the first exhibit, documenting the objections of the then mayors to the project. Informally, it is known as the I Told You So.
Oh, wow. That's good. But is the bubblator down there?
I think so.
Didn't mention.
Oh.
Is anyone hesitant to drive the viaduct?
I've always been hesitant to drive the viaduct.
Okay, so no change.
But I will tell you that, and this doesn't make me look very good, but right after the earthquake in 2001, like every other journalist in town, I went down to see how Pioneer Square was doing and actually how CenturyLink Field was. It was under construction at the time. And so all those beams, and there were workers kind of trying to right all the beams and everything. And on the way back, not thinking, I drove on the viaduct. I was the only car on the viaduct.
Oh.
After a while, I was like, where are all the other cars?
Wow.
But
I love
pretty
it.
Soon a trooper...
Joni's like, better get up on the viaduct where it's safe.
I wouldn't look good after this story.
Bond, what else are our listeners imagining?
Estacia says, desperate to make something of the debacle, Seattle builds its first downtown school in the hole.
School in the hole.
Students in 40 years have no idea why it's called the Bertha School.
Oh.
Poor Bertha Landis, by the way.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so
not fair to her.
So outrageous. A, to name it after a woman, and B, to name it after her. That's just awful.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, any other contributions from our listeners?
Here's one slightly more optimistic vision.
Oh, good.
Brian says, Bertha restarts after far too long and too much money, but the waterfront is a beautiful place to be, not marred by a hideous viaduct and highway traffic noise, and it was ultimately the right decision to make.
Hmm.
I prefer to leave us with that.
Aw.
But instead, I'm going to leave you with one more thing from Seattle's former mayor, Charles Royer, who told the Seattle Times he's not panicked. Quote, the viaduct has been sinking since I was mayor. If you look at the x-rays beneath the viaduct, some of those pilings are floating. It's got to come down pretty soon. Hopefully, it's by the hand of the state rather than the hand of God. End quote. But he's not panicked. You're with KUOW.
He's also not mayor.
Not mayor. KUOW's Week in Review, back in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review with Phyllis Fletcher, managing editor at the Northwest News Network, Canute Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com, Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. And we're analyzing the week's top stories this week. Well, let me ask you a question. What does the phrase Seattle process mean to you? Does Seattle process mean we do things the right way around here? Or that we whinge endlessly. For better or worse, Seattle schools are famous for process, but this week the school board decided to forego the process of conducting a national search for school superintendent and just make interim super Larry Nyland the permanent chief, or as permanent as a Seattle school superintendent can be. Turnover has been high at that position the last decade or so. School board president Sherry Carr says, enough. We've got our man.
Here we have a highly qualified candidate with a proven track record of success. And the thing that I have been so struck by is he has amazingly quickly been able to assess some of the root cause issues of Seattle Public Schools and has begun to set the organization on a course of action.
Okay, he's pretty good, but fast-tracking his appointment, hiring Larry Nyland without doing a national search, that does not sit well with critics, including history teacher Jesse Hagopian, who gave us one example of Nyland's failure to follow procedure.
When he signed off on a Gates grant to the Seattle Public Schools without passing it through the correct channels and getting the signatures from the Seattle School Board. That was troubling to many, many people who follow the Seattle Public Schools. And that's been a constant problem in the Seattle Public Schools of superintendents not following the correct fiscal procedures.
Phyllis Fletcher, what do we need to know to understand what's going on here?
Well, let's take a step back, look at all what all happened. So what happened? The school board president put it on their agenda to hire him the day before Thanksgiving. They were going to do it the following week, and people were upset, and they delayed that a little and then hired him this week with a 5-2 vote. So he's done a lot of stuff. He went to Roosevelt, Rough Riders, hey. He was a superintendent in Pasco and Marysville, and he has fans and people who say he's a nice guy. So let's scope it out to superintendent hirings overall. So we've seen some hirings that have happened like this, where they're interim and then they're promoted. So Rajman Haas was hired that way. Joseph Olszewski was hired that way. And then you see national searches where the last superintendent, Jose Banda, and Maria Goodloe Johnson were also hired in national searches. And then there was a national search before Manhas, I believe, that just completely collapsed. So neither process is fully satisfying to people. By my observation, if you're one of the candidates, you really don't like it. But things do come out in a national search, and when people are compared against each other, that we maybe wouldn't have found out otherwise. But then it's funny, one of the things that ends up happening is the candidate that becomes the person who's hired is kind of hired by attrition. The other candidates drop out. I saw that happen with both of the national searches that I just mentioned. So on the one hand, in a national search, the public gets information and they get, you know, a voice that they might not have otherwise. But then when you look at the superintendents, did it really make a difference as far as quality and what ended up happening? It's really hard to say. And I want to point out also that we had an interim superintendent who a lot of people really supported, who was not offered this deal last time around, and it was Susan Enfield. And Joni, you might remember that moment. I broke that story on the air when you were right here, that she was leaving because she wasn't getting that offer, and she's at Highline now.
Yeah, so it's not dime a dozen, as you point out. There are mixed results from different kinds of searches. The best national search, I do date myself, was the one that produced John Stanford. Mm-hmm. He was a rock star here. Some people say if he had stayed much longer, it wouldn't have gone that well. Mm. But, you know, look, this school district has had too much turnover, too much tumult here. So what is she? Larry Nyland will be the fifth superintendent in 10 years. Is that the right number?
It sounds right. And I have to say that's about typical for major, you know, for large urban school systems. It's not that unusual.
Yes, I know that. They the very, very short tenure for these folks. When mm-hmm. they start, they got to do everything in a hurry because they're not going to last long. Mm-mm. But sometimes the answer is right in front of you, is the other point here. And in this case, that seems to be what the 5-2 are saying. So you have to weigh that against, you know, a national search, it takes a very, very long time. During that time, the parents, the students, they feel like, ah, we're stalled here. We're more stalled than Bertha. Can you imagine?
So if we're saying that actually the turnover at Seattle school superintendent is really no different from any other big city in the country, are we also exaggerating the Seattle process? How real do you think that phenomenon is?
Well,
I'll take any answer.
I'll take any answer. Okay, look, Seattle is famed for its process, and process is a way of, if you look at it, the successful renditions of it, it is a way of bringing everyone to the table a la minimum wage, and you end up with a result that, you know, took a few months. It wasn't like, you know, the campaign slogan happened in a second, but then you got a result. But sometimes Seattle process is an excuse for not doing too much and stalling everything because you're just waiting for the next thing.
But why would we do that? Why would who wants to stall things? Like, what do you think is going on that we're so process oriented? Why does it happen?
First of all, there's political safety in a certain amount of process. If everybody buys into a candidate, if you have the choice of the Seattle police chief, for example, did a national search, candidates dropped out, and then you picked somebody who appears at least so far to be a very good candidate who had essentially a consensus that was almost a consensus choice. That means that if it doesn't work out, the political risk is shared. It's not in the case of a school board where you're not, you know, not doing a national search. So you're essentially saying this guy's good enough talent, but we're not going to go for the best of the best or whatever. And even though the outcomes might be different, if you erode people's confidence in how the decision was made, you risk the backlash if it goes bad.
So sometimes there's something to be said for going through process, even if you think it's not going to help the outcome. It's just what you do to keep people...
Keep trust. Keep trust or get consensus or get close to it or spread the political risk out as far as you can. So everybody's got 2% risk as opposed to 90% risk. So the school board owns this candidate now or this superintendent now. So the onus is all going to be on them. Mm-hmm. If it goes bad, you will have, a large constituency of people who said, hey, I didn't have any say in it. That's a risk. Now, that may be a risk worth taking. He may be that good. But that's why the other process is considered, I think, valuable, even if it can be a huge headache.
And people like information. You know, we're in the news and information business. Mm-hmm. They like news. They like information. They like to compare the different people and find out things about their background. People like that kind of involvement, and they don't get that in this kind of process. They get, you know, the risk benefit, you know, thing that Knut just laid out.
Yeah. Phyllis makes a great point. I'm just thinking about, you know, people ask, oh, could we do the World's Fair again and whatnot? And I read them.
Who asks that?
Yeah.
Me.
Yeah. People want to know. I mean, because that was seen as a place where Seattle cut through process, did this great positive thing.
I see.
And the question is, gee, could we do that today? We can't even, you know, do the waterfront or make a tunnel or do anything without all this controversy. And Eddie Carlson, who headed up the World's Fair effort, wrote a memoir in the 1980s. And in that memoir, he said, a lot of the World's Fair happened in these private breakfasts with small, you know, groups of
businessmen. It was all napkins, right?
It was just, you know, guys getting together for 7:30 breakfast at the Olympic Hotel to decide the fate of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, by the 1980s, he said, you couldn't do it nowadays because the public is too inquisitive.
Oh,
it goes to Phyllis's point.
Yeah. So
inquisitive people.
So if Larry Nyland turns out to be the waterfront Ferris wheel of Seattle Public Schools, we all win.
There you go.
Just for a little context, finally, if you're relatively new to Seattle, I once, in a previous show called Rewind, this must have been 20 years ago, I did a bit where I cut up audio from a Seattle school board meeting. And I had them, or it could have been city council, and I had them ordering Chinese food. But you just dropped in the exact audio from the meeting, you know. Well, I just want to circle back here. And it was
that is
true 20
idea.
Years ago, and there's still something to
Did
it.
Any food arrive?
I forget how the sketch turned out. We'll have to go back to the archives.
That's awesome, because when I used to live tweet school board meetings, I used to, like, half of my tweets were about what teriyaki order I was going to make as soon as I could get out of there.
Right? By the way, Jesse Hagopian and school board president Sherry Carr talked with KUOW's The Record, which cranks up. It spins again at noon today. They're going to be talking what makes a holiday movie a classic and what makes one forgettable with the programming director at the Seattle International Film Festival. Join us for The Record at noon. Tavis Smiley at 11 o'clock, too, but this is KUOW's Week in Review. The rest of America is paying less than $3 for a gallon of regular. Not quite around here, right? I think the Puget Sound area is 306, and I'm seeing like 320 in the city.
319 is what I just saw, yeah.
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 One reason that we are higher than the rest of the country is that we have a fairly high gas tax. Well, what if our gas tax were zero? This week, our State Transportation Commission voted to test out a road usage charge, a pay-by-mile system. Joni Balter, how would this work?
Okay, so this would be a test or a demonstration of the idea. So think about the gas tax, and this is sort of good news, bad news type stuff here. So because we have more fuel-efficient cars, we have electric cars and all that good stuff, the gas tax revenues are stagnating. And in the future, we'll do so even more. So what to do about roads and infrastructure? California and Oregon have been looking at, and for years so has the state of Washington, just in an academic way. But now they want to put this out on the road, shall we say, with maybe 1,000 to 2,000 volunteers who would decide they're not going to pay the gas tax. They are going to pay a usage tax, a pay by the mile. And these are just suggested rates, so this isn't the exact rate, something like 1.8 or 1.9 cents per mile. And how would you do this? Well, you'd have you could possibly use your odometer. You could to tell how many miles you owed, or you could pay a flat rate and just drive till you stop or something like that. But then the other items are
like all you can eat.
Yeah, all you can eat. All you can eat.
One fee.
And the other ones are sort of mileage counters in the car, GPS, that kind of thing.
Ooh.
Ooh, GPS.
Wait a minute.
I know
what
going.
Else are they tracking with the GPS?
So I did speak with State Representative Reuven Carlisle about that GPS situation. And so obviously privacy, as soon as this comes up, people are going to go, I don't want you tracking where I went.
My speed?
The transportation.
My tailgating?
No, it's just
my following distance?
Well, that you need to be followed on. But the Transportation Commission says, calm down, everybody, that it would be checking the number of miles, not the where of the miles. But, you know, how are you going to convince me of that? Because how did you get that? So that will be an absolutely big deal about this if it gets beyond the demonstration part of it. But they have to find out if this would work, if drivers would go for this. Could they manage the technical parts? And, you know, one way to look at this is that we talk to we want businesses to innovate and look to the future. And this is an example of the transportation department saying, we have to know what the future holds. We don't think the gas tax is gonna work in the future. So what next? We have to pay for roads and infrastructure.
Okay, we're going to say more about this in a moment. I want to hear from KUOW listeners. Again, KUOW's Bon Huberman. What say we?
Well, Alyssa says, roads are shared infrastructure, period. Anyone who thinks they don't use them because they don't drive is delusional. Goods that you purchase came to you via the roads. Emergency services come to you via the roads. This is basic infrastructure and should not be a targeted tax.
So she's saying that it's not enough to measure how much we drive because we use the roads in other ways?
Well, I think the objection is that it's essentially a user tax in the same way that tolls are. People say general tax money ought to be used to create public infrastructure for the common use, rich and poor alike, and roads should be part of that. But increasingly, mainly because the technology makes it so much easier, is that you can put transponders into vehicles and record, if you want, you can record where people go, but you can certainly record what roads they use. And I think what this, you know, the technology is eventually going to get us to the point where the temptation of this is going to prove irresistible from a policy standpoint, because not only could you have a state mileage tax that would fund transportation and that kind of thing, you could also have local taxes, because these things can read which county you're in. They could even read whether you're on an arterial or whether you're on a side road.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at what the transportation policy discussions are, it really is all about how to change the whole way we think about driving, where we drive, and how we pay for it. The other interesting thing is they can't get rid of the gas tax entirely. So there would be a double tax if they did this, because we've bonded against the gas tax. So you can't, if you've borrowed money against the gas tax,
yeah,
you got to keep charging the gas tax. But
double taxation. I think that's going to fly, especially with the Republican legislature.
They would not doubly tax any individual driver, so it would take a long year to roll out. So just to be clear here, if you are in this program, the pay-by-the-mile program, then you don't pay the gas tax. There's a mechanism and a way to report back that you are paying by the mile and not the gas tax.
I see.
But they do bond, so they do. It would take a long time to roll out.
Speaking of bond.
Kate posted to our Facebook page, you could call this plan Bring On Climate Change. Heavier vehicles with low mileage are rewarded while lighter weight fuel efficient cars carry the load.
Yeah, aren't gas taxes an incentive to use better mileage cars?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. If the way I've chosen to be conscientious, if I've chosen something that has high miles per gallon, you know, how do I feel about this? How do I fit in? And also the whole rural, you know, rural drivers right. have to go really long distances, and how would this affect them?
Especially if the reason you're driving a long distance is because you can't afford to live where you'd like mm-hmm. to live. Yeah. Now you're paying again.
Yeah, there's a whole social equity issue to these taxes, mm-hmm. and whether they're progressive or regressive, and whether or not are we going to eventually have a transportation culture that's, you know, if you can pay for it, you can have it, mm. and if you can't pay for it, you can't have it, you know,
yeah.
kind of thing. I mean, it's true to a certain extent now, but with the increase of tolls and things like that, it's going more in that direction. And these are huge decisions that we need to make.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does. It sort of looks to a future that is beyond people behaving as well as Phyllis here. It looks to a future when we already accept that. We already build that into our system, mm-hmm. that the gas tax has made people drive more fuel-efficient cars. But then think about this side of the fairness thing. Who is driving the electric cars right now and the better gas mileage cars? It tends to be people who can afford the newer cars mm-hmm. that are built mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. So that's how they answer the equity.
Interesting. That's a fair point. Okay, Bond, any more? One more listener comment before we turn the page?
Joshua says, right now, cars that don't use gas are getting free roads. I think you should be taxed based on how much you use the roads. Mm. Hate giant SUVs all you want, but if they only use 5 miles of roadway on a daily basis, why should they pay more taxes than a tree hugger who pays 45 miles a day using zero gas?
All right.
Hard to hug trees when you're driving.
Yes. It's dangerous, too.
Sometimes they hug you, though.
No.
One more road note. Have you ever gotten caught by a red light camera and ticketed for running the light? Not if you're a bicyclist, you haven't. Como TV talked to a ticketed driver who says, that's not fair, and we should pull the plug on red light cameras until they are fair. Seattle driver Karen Parrish showed the Como reporter a video of her and a cyclist both being naughty.
Now the cyclist is entering. I'm clear.
The camera shows a bike rider blowing through the light 2 seconds later.
I want to know why, when two people commit the same infraction, only one of us receive a red light ticket.
She paid the $124 fine, yet she cannot stop thinking about the bike rider in that video.
It is an unfair application of the law. If they are supposed to be following the same rules of the road that I follow, there should be a system in place that they can get an infraction for committing the same offense that I commit.
Should we either make cyclists carry license plates or let everyone go?
There's a mayoral campaign theme.
Well,
yeah,
Seattle's
tried
bike licenses in the past. They didn't go over very well. Oh. So that's an idea that's come along. At the turn of the century, when we had our big bike culture, we had bicycle policemen who ticketed bike riders.
Oh,
so you had the turn of which century?
The 19th. Sorry.
Wow.
I'm talking about in 1900, Seattle had bike police officers who on bikes whose job was to enforce the biking laws, and they would chase these guys around. They had amazing thighs, I think.
Well, that's this woman's point. You can't chase them around with a red light
camera. No, I mean, she has a great point with the red light camera. There's a lot of reason to hate those cameras being caught by one, mainly,
yeah.
But mm-hmm. but other issues of equity and whatnot, and they're basically they're like speed traps. They're designed to generate revenue. They're not designed to make things safer.
Mm. Well, what do you mean? They're stopping you from running a red light. Doesn't that make things
maybe
safer?
Folks could stop running the red lights? How about that?
Yeah, how about that? Follow the process
or
the Seattle process.
Yeah.
Plus the license plate on your head, strapped on your head as a bicyclist. It's not aerodynamic, and it's not ideal.
Slows you down, yes.
Coming up on the Week in Review, we will not comply. Stay tuned. You've been shopping. You've been making a year-end tax planning. You've been busy. We are condensing the week gone by for you on the Week in Review. The state of Washington is preparing for as many as 6,000 gun rights advocates to attend a rally at the Capitol tomorrow. And this week, our Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins, told us that this gun rights rally is already irritating two people on the other side of the country.
Parents of two of the victims of the Newtown school shooting issued a statement via the group Sandy Hook Promise. Nicole Hockley and Mark Barden say they support Washington's new law, and they question the timing of this event just one day before the anniversary of the school shooting that left 20 students and six adults dead.
Now, the ralliers say that tomorrow they're going to openly exchange guns. They're going to violate Initiative 594 in every possible way. I'm quoting from them. So I'll ask the same question that was asked all of last week about people protesting grand jury decisions in Ferguson and New York. Is this civil disobedience rally accomplishing anything or just annoying the good law-abiding people?
Well, we have to let, you know, both sides have the right to protest, left, right. They get to do that. And so that is what the State Patrol decided. They're not going to interfere with this. That said, that doesn't make it a smart protest the way that it's planned. So you have a bunch of people saying we will not comply. They are standing next to some folks who have some pretty sort of rough reputations, let's say. This is the son of Clive and Bundy, a family that doesn't believe in paying grazing fees. So that isn't...
This is a who's who of Tea Party patriots.
This is a who's who of why are you standing next to these people would be one way to put it. Because, you know, so what is it? You only like the laws you like? You like your law of the Second Amendment and even some distorted renditions of it. Mm-hmm. But this law was passed by the voters and it's just, you just don't like it. So you'll just, you know, not follow it.
I mentioned Austin Jenkins, Phyllis Fletcher. We're covering this in Olympia. Are we sending a reporter tomorrow?
He'll be there tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's as we've spoken about, it was, I guess you could call it an eye roller for the State Patrol. You know, they have made it very clear. We do not plan on making arrests for this type of violation. It is a protest that points out some things in the law that were written in a way that these folks don't like.
Like what?
The whole language about what's a transfer. It's defined in the law as including things that these folks don't think it should include, like certain types of transferring of a gun. If you're going to do it for hunting, you have to be hunting while you're doing the transfer. Things like that they don't like the way it was written. But I don't know that they're going to violate 594 in every possible way, but I guess we'll find out. They're going to, I think, violate the ones that they find annoying.
Okay. Does this rally have a permit?
Hmm.
Because I believe I read that the state told the organizer of this rally that another group had a permit for that date. And then he said, I'm not asking your permission. I don't know if you understand how civil disobedience works. I'm trying to civilly disobey here. So I don't care. So I don't know whether that affects whether the state police are going to make any arrests or not.
They have an implied permit. And if they don't, if they may have a real permit, but they for sure have an implied permit. Because
what's an implied permit?
No one's going to mess with them is an implied permit.
Because, right. And you can't, there's certain political things you can't exercise prior restraint on. I think if they're going to go to the Capitol and have an anti-government, anti-gun control protest, they have to be very tolerant, just as I think Seattle police have been reasonable in the way that they've been handling the Ferguson and anarchist protests that have gone around downtown. And the thing that where I don't think they're doing themselves any favors, and I don't think they care about that because the views are fairly extreme. I mean, these are people who, you know, are very anti-government. As Joni said, you know, don't believe they should pay government fees of any
raising
kind
fees,
of that kind of thing.
None of those.
So it's very much a kind of militia patriot wing. And that just does not reflect where mainstream Washingtonians are. I mean, the bill passed, you know, by big numbers, and it was voted on by a lot of conservatives. A lot of Republicans voted for the gun measure. And so this is sort of a fringe of a fringe. It's a fringe of the gun rights movement. It's not the mainstream of the gun rights movement. And if you look at the list of speakers, you can see.
So
you
think this will where they're coming though, from? If I can add,
out of towners.
No, no. I mean, out of towners participated on the other
hands side. Off Washington State.
No, the out of towners participated on the other side, 4594. So we are seen as a little bit of a battleground for that. So folks come in, but as Skip said, these are a bit fringy.
Yeah. So you're predicting that this will alienate more voters than it'll convince?
Well, civil disobedience always risks that because and civil disobedience with guns in your hand is very tricky. It's tricky enough for some people without guns in their hand, but it's tricky with it, so it has to be handled well. But I think it's important that they have an opportunity to go to a public place and pitch their bad ideas.
We will be at that public place, Austin Jenkins.
Yep.
We'll be there tomorrow and tune in over the weekend, and we'll, I'm sure, discuss this a week from now on KUOW's Week in Review. Coming up next, what does Paul Allen's brain say about Seattle on a cellular level? Stay tuned. Good morning. You're reviewing the news with us from Seattle Channel and Bloomberg View, Joni Balter, from Crosscut.com and Seattle Magazine, Knut Berger, and from the Northwest News Network, Phyllis Fletcher. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. This week, Paul Allen announced he's donating $100 million for the Allen Institute for Cell Science in Seattle. He wants to unravel the inner workings of human cells, to understand their gigantic role in human disease, and of course, to develop cures. And I am just blown away by what is boiling in Seattle. There was already all the health research, private and university. But then from the Microsoft guys alone, we have the Gates Foundation, Paul Allen's Artificial Intelligence Institute. He's put $500 million into his Institute for Brain Science, which will share a building with the Cellular Institute in South Lake Union. Knut, are we the world capital of philanthropic futurism?
I don't know. You know, I can't say whether we're the world capital. We're certainly a center of it, mostly because these guys have so much money they can put into these things. And you know, Paul Allen is I sometimes get the feeling he's a guy who sees like a really great Nova special and then decides I'm gonna solve that one. You know,
go back to the Nova episodes and see if we can exactly track his interest.
Exactly. You know, Carl.
They
Sagan
do something
says,
about NFL football on Nova.
Right. Carl Sagan says it. You know, I'm gonna fund it. And which I think is terrific. I mean, one of the things he's doing is pumping money into basic science, the kind of stuff that doesn't necessarily in the short term have a commercial value. It's the kind of stuff that takes many years. And I know nothing beyond high school biology about cells. I thought it was interesting reading about it. I didn't realize there was as much mystery to how cells operate, how they reproduce, how they go wrong, why they behave differently in certain situations. It turns out that there are all kinds of elements, like bodies, particles, et cetera, within the cells, that it's terribly complex. And when you think
Well, the hope is if there were not a mystery, we wouldn't have cancer. Well, that's the
right.
hope.
Yes, exactly. And but it turns out that understanding cells is fundamental to literally every disease, everything that we define as a disease. Mm. And so I think it's great that he's doing it. I think it's fascinating. I think it's money well spent.
So my next question, well, I'll open this up, but I want to know if you think this is just an accident of Bill and Paul's birth. Does this say something about Seattle? I mean, could it, you know, imagine if Microsoft, another version of it, had been founded by a couple of, you know, forward-thinking high school kids in Irving, Texas, who had a completely different set of life interests. You know, is this random?
I don't think it is entirely random. I mean, partly It has to do with the way they were educated and schooled. They went to a high school that valued the life of the mind. Both of them were interested in science and technology at an early age. I mean, thank goodness they weren't born in, 1300 or something, because they happened to be born into an era that could match their obsession with computers and that kind of thing. But they both came from families. Paul Allen's father was a librarian at the University of Washington. Bill Gates's mother, Mary Gates, incredible civic activist and stalwart. So his father as well. They came from environments where they cared about science. They cared about learning. They cared about the life of the mind. And so it doesn't surprise me. I think they've been nurtured in that, and they're paying back in the same way.
Well, aren't we lucky we have these modern-day Medicis where this city benefits from it? But Allen and Gates aren't the only ones who looked at this region and said, that's the place to do something. Jeff Bezos picked this place for Amazon, and the city's changing. But I've been struck this fall specifically by a couple of things of how, so Ebola breaks out and the world is shaking in different ways about it. And both Bill Gates and Paul Allen said, well, all right, pass the hat. We're in for big amounts. I don't know the exact amount, but it was, multi-millions in both cases. Mm-hmm. We're lucky we have the ability to jump on new things right here.
Just to go back to the history of it a little bit, both of them grew up, the connections to the University of Washington for both of them were very strong through family and through their own access to computers and that kind of thing. Remember, at the time they were growing up in the 60s and 70s was the time when Warren G. Magnuson was funneling NIH money to the university, turning it into a major health and medical research facility. We had medical technology companies, Physiocontrol and others, developing things here in the early 60s in heart research and heart monitoring, kidney research. So they were part of that context. And I think that the University of Washington is a big piece of that. And that didn't happen by accident.
Mm-hmm. How much do you trust Paul Allen to use his private brain and cell discoveries for good? Are we assuming that, because some people don't think Jeff Bezos, who you brought up, that Amazon is so great. Are we assuming that they're the good guy? We're the good guys in Seattle.
Well, I'm going to assume that research into cells and brains is a good thing because, when it's your family member or somebody you care about. And
he's opening it up to other people.
Right. It's not just about Paul Allen or his handpicked people. There will be these places will employ a lot of people. And so the idea of having just the best people in the world, if we can, in these areas, come here to Seattle and feed off each other. And that the story's talked about that at length, that the idea was not just to have a couple, but to have just the best people we could bring together here, working together and coming up with the answers. I'm going to assume goodwill on that one.
What did Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs do? They were both born in the Bay Area. How did they handle their money? Were they? I don't remember them. I don't think of philanthropy and Wozniak and Jobs.
Yeah, when I think of Wozniak, and I think about those rock concerts he...
Right.
I mean, you want to...
Paul Allen does that, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, you kind of want a billionaire to have some fun, right?
Right.
Ever hear of the Seahawks?
Well, we'll talk Seahawks, and by the way, Paul Allen has donated to elephant conservation, and we're gonna touch on that, too. Some quick news updates in a moment. Yes, Joni?
I was just going to say, amazing segue, so...
Thank you, Joni. Appreciate that. Best segue money can buy. Coming up with more Week in Review in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Phyllis Fletcher, Knute Berger, and Joni Balter coming toward the end here. So let's just update you on a couple few news stories. You recall last month, all of Seattle media, including us, we were telling you about the closure of the beloved Caribbean sandwich shop Paseo, known for its Cuban pork and its line of people along Fremont Avenue waiting to eat it. The company got hit with a big wage theft lawsuit, abruptly closed up shop, and filed for bankruptcy. And it looks like Paseo could return. Late last week, a Seattle investor paid $91,000 at auction for the Paseo name and equipment, not the recipes. Former owner Lorenzo Lorenzo says the recipes are his. A judge is expected to approve the sale today. But it can't ever be the same, right?
What's up with that, man? I mean, yeah. were people standing there for the name and the shape of the building, or were they standing there for the sandwiches right. they preferred? Which, again, mayonnaise on something hot with lettuce, not my thing.
Right.
But
tricky to pull off.
Yeah. But, you know, people who stood in that line loved it. I think it might have had something to do with the recipe.
Quick update on sports. Seahawks are back. They have the number one defense in the NFL again, even when you take into account the way they started the season. Seahawks are playing the 49ers this Sunday. Didn't the Seahawks already play the 49ers? Mm-hmm. Does that happen in one season usually?
You play your division rival twice.
Oh, okay. The Huskies are in the 2014 Ticket City Cactus Bowl game.
There's a household term.
Are you going to watch?
Sure.
Really?
Sure.
Okay. Do you know that the UW basketball program is undefeated? Husky basketball, undefeated and ranked now. Can you name a single player?
No.
No, you cannot. Neither can anyone. Only three players in the team are local? They're all from some, and those three are all freshmen. This isn't starting lineup. It's just, you know, college is looking like pro these days. They're just from wherever they're from. And finally, an elephant update. You know, the zoo is owned by the city of Seattle, and it gets a third of its annual funding from public sources. But last week, some angry activists showed up to a meeting, and they wanted to rally, and they couldn't get in. But Seattle Times reports zoo officials say they're going to review their meeting practices. And the activists were chanting, "Free chai, free bamboo, just another zoo won't do. Make them safe, make them merry, send them to a sanctuary."
Aww.
That's a good song.
It's a good chant, right? Well, they were thinking this out because the holiday theme continues on Monday. Friends of Woodland Park Zoo elephants will carol throughout City Hall to Christmas songs reworded to promote Bamboo and Chai's retirement to a sanctuary. I'm not making that up. So Monday, City Hall, they'll be singing, who knows, Rudolph the Lesser Known Red-Nosed Elephant. Grandma is lucky she only got run over by a reindeer. Keep me away from a manger because there's a baby in there and that's not safe. Please, God, don't let it snow. Let it snow. We're from a warm climate. Would it kill you to send me to a wildlife sanctuary? And all drummer boys are little to me. Just some of the songs that you'll hear on Monday. KOW's Week in Review, produced by Jason Pagano, with Knute Berger and Phyllis Fletcher and Joni Balter. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
Join us again in a week.